Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 246, Exploring Savant Syndrome with Dr. Daryl Treffert. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Three groups, then: the autistic or central nervous system disability with savant skills in people generally from birth. Then there's the second group, who are neurotypical people who, after some kind of an injury, suddenly show savant ability, sometimes at a what I call prodigious level. And then there's this third category of neurotypical people who have this sudden epiphany of music or art, which was not present before.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Daryl Treffert, discussing his research on the fascinating condition known as Savant Syndrome. Daryl Treffert, MD, a Wisconsin psychiatrist, has been studying Savant Syndrome for over 40 years. His most recent publication, Islands of Genius, The Bountiful Mind of the Autistic, Acquired and Sudden Savant, was published by Jessica Kingsley Incorporated in April 2010 in both the United States and England. His earlier book, Extraordinary People, was the first work to comprehensively summarize what is known about this fascinating condition, originally described a century ago, and to introduce the reader to a number of present-day prodigious savants such as Leslie, Alonzo, and George. Many persons remember these three remarkable persons from the 1980 60 Minutes program about them. Dr. Treffert was also a consultant to the movie Rain Man, in which Dustin Hoffman portrayed an autistic savant. In addition to his work in the area of savant syndrome, Dr. Treffert has lectured nationally for a number of years on the topic of mellowing. His booklet, Mellowing: Lessons from Listening, has been widely distributed. Another area of writing and speaking has been on the rights of the mentally ill with respect to balancing clinical realities with legal rights. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Daryl Treffert, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, I've been reading your fascinating book, Islands of Genius, and I must say, what a fascinating front row seat you've had in spending the past 40 years studying a remarkable range of savants.
Yeah, it has been a real opportunity and a real privilege to get to know these people and their special skills and their families. So it started as a bit of a hobby when I met my first savants in 1962 when I started a children's unit there, but it since has sort of morphed into pretty much a full-time occupation because of the website and the attention that savant syndrome is getting, particularly since the movie Rain Man.
So you got started when you were at the University of Wisconsin and you were running a clinic for children, is that right?
Well, what happened is that I finished my residency at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and then was assigned the responsibility of starting a children's unit at a hospital in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, Winnebago State Hospital, it was called at that time. At that time, the hospital had about 800 patients, and a number of them were under 18. And so my task was to take those patients who were under 18 and put them into a separate children's unit instead of having them just housed on the adult units. And so we gathered together about 30 such patients from the general population and put them on the unit. And most of those youngsters were autistic and, of course, really severely so. Otherwise, they would not have been in an institution. But three of those caught my eye, particularly. Now, one little guy had memorized the bus system of the city of Milwaukee. And if you told him the time of day and the bus number, he would tell you what corner that bus is going by just then. He knew the routes much better than the bus drivers themselves. Another little guy who was severely autistic, in fact, he was mute, but you could put a 250-piece jigsaw puzzle in front of him face down on the table, and he would put it together like with the rhythm of a sewing machine just from looking at the geometric shapes. And then there was a third little guy who was an expert on what happened in this day in history. And so each morning I would come in and say, "Dr. Trefford, do you know what happened on this day in history?" And I'd try to bone up the night before because I knew I was going to get asked, and I could never memorize him with these. So I became interested in this condition at that time based on these three individuals.
Well, I guess so. That's amazing. Now, these people used to be referred to as idiot savants, and I gather that rather denigrating designation is no longer in use. And in fact, you wrote a paper evidently that was responsible for the shift in terminology. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. What the term, when I first started studying this in 62, it was called the idiot savant. And actually that term turned out to be a very sort of a cruel term and one of derision. But when it was originally coined in 1887 by Dr. J. Langdon Down, who's better known for having named Down syndrome, at that time, just like I, he was impressed with some patients he had seen in his career. And he presented a paper to his colleagues, and he said, "You know, I want to tell you now about 10 patients that have really caught my eye during these 30 years of his career." And he described 10 patients. One little lad had memorized the rise and fall of the Roman Empire word for word, and he could read it to you forward or backward. At that time, the term idiot meant an IQ below 25, and savant was from a French word which means knowledgeable person. And so Dr. Down put these two together, idiot, a scientific term, with savant, learned person, and called it the idiot savant. Of course, over the years, idiot fell into disrepute and a term of derision. So even though the term idiot savant stuck, so in I wrote a paper in the 70s indicating that about savant syndrome, and I said it's time to change the term, and suggested we call it savant syndrome, and that term has stuck since that time.
Yes, and part of the reason the word idiot was associated with it was that it was thought at the time that it occurs only among people with a developmental disorder like autism, but you found that not to be the case, right?
That's right. Savant syndrome occurs in autism and Asperger's as frequently as 1 in 10 individuals, but it also occurs in other people who have other forms of central nervous system dysfunction. It may be mental retardation. It may be organic brain syndrome or even Tourette's, for example. So that about half of the persons that I know of who are savants are autistic, and the other half have other central nervous system disorders.
Wow. 1 out of 10 autistic people show some signs of savantism. I was surprised to see that it was so high.
Well, I was too, frankly, it's been a question which needs more exploration is why is it as high as 1 in 10? But it certainly is, and I think part of the reason is because some of the research shows that there is left hemisphere dysfunction in autism itself. And savant syndrome, in most cases, is associated with left hemisphere dysfunction. So if you have a disorder which already shows some left hemisphere dysfunction, it would not be surprising then to see an increased number of savants in that particular class of individuals.
Now, you talk about three main categories of savants: autistic, acquired, and sudden. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can take us through those and explain what each of those are.
Yeah, autistic savants are the ones that I think most people are familiar with, including Raymond Babbitt in the movie Rain Man was a autistic savant. And as part of associated with their autism, in 1 in 10 cases, are some extraordinary or remarkable abilities that stand in contrast to the overall disability. It's most of the time these skills are in music, art, calendar calculating, lightning calculating, or visual spatial abilities. And these, as I said, occur in about 1 in 10. And however, as we just discussed, it can occur in persons with other central nervous system disabilities as well. So that's the, I think it might be more accurate to call them the congenital savants, in the sense that they are present from birth, whether autism or some other disability. But about 10 years ago, I began to run into a series of cases of people who were normal, and the politically correct term for normal now is neurotypical. Mm. Normal has sort of, people feel that, well, anyway, even that term is not politically correct. And so now we have to use the term neurotypical, and that's what people who don't have any disabilities are. I began to run into a series of cases of neurotypical people. These are people who were entirely functioning entirely normally, who had some kind of a central nervous system incident. It might be a head injury. It might be some dementia. It might be a stroke or other incidents, getting hit in the head with baseball, for example. And after that, some abilities began to emerge, sometimes at a startling level that were never present before. Dr. Bruce Miller in San Francisco has a series of 12 cases with a particular form of dementia called frontotemporal dementia, which is a little different than Alzheimer's. But each of these patients developed either musical or art skills after, as the dementia proceeded. And some of them had never picked up a paintbrush before in their life, and yet when you look at their paintings, they're striking. They're magnificent, actually. And then there was a case of here in the States of a young boy who got hit in the head by a baseball at age 10. And after that, he began to calendar calculate, which he had never done before. And similar cases of what I call the acquired savant. And as I said, these are neurotypical people who have some kind of a central nervous system incident. And then some savant abilities emerge, sometimes at a prodigious or at a remarkable level. And of course, that raises two questions. One is, what kind of dormant capacity might exist within us all? And secondly, if that's true, how can you tap that without having a stroke or some central nervous incident? So that's the acquired savant. And that has really captured my interest, particularly in the last 10 years, as more of these cases come to my attention. And then there's something I call the sudden savant. And these are, again, neurotypical people who do not have any particular central nervous incident, but at some point, savant abilities emerge very quickly in a sort of an epiphany. And I have several cases now of sort of a musical epiphany. These are people who, they might have been struggling trying to learn an instrument or sort of plodding along learning art. But all of a sudden, I'm talking within seconds, the whole rules of music or rules of math or rules of art are opened up to them, and they begin to perform musically, for example, in a way that they had never performed before. And but the point is that this is really these are not, should not be called savants, in the sense that savant by definition means a disability. So we have these three groups then: the autistic or central nervous system disability with savant skills in people generally from birth. Then there's the second group, who are neurotypical people who, after some kind of an injury, suddenly show savant ability, sometimes at a what I call prodigious level. And then there's this third category of neurotypical people who have this sudden epiphany of music or art, which was not present before.
Now, that's really fascinating, and we'll get back into those different types. But you mentioned kind of in passing that the internet gave a big boost to research on savants. How so?
Well, after the movie Rain Man, let me start by saying that the movie Rain Man made autistic savant a household term, whereas before there was very little attention paid to it, and the reports in the literature were largely scattered and anecdotal and gee whiz, look at that sort of thing, but without any real public recognition of the condition. Along came the movie Rain Man and gave some recognition to that phenomenon. I actually was a consultant to the movie Rain Man and was working on my first book at that time called Extraordinary People. And as a result of the public interest in savant syndrome, I started what I called a clearinghouse, which was a place where people could write, and I would send information out to them on savant syndrome. And then in the 90s, the natural way to do that was to start a website. And so with the Wisconsin Medical Society, we started a website called www.savantsyndrome.com, where people could look at examples of savant syndrome and bring to my attention examples that I obviously didn't know about. We have thousands of hits a day on that website now, and from all over the world, and everything from students who want to write a term paper to researchers to teachers who want to learn how to deal with these to a large number, which come in to me sort of, I've got a son or daughter who, or I've got a brother who, or I've got a relative who, and they bring to my attention these new cases. And it's a natural way to very quickly learn about them. If it weren't for the internet, this would be done through correspondence, and that would, you know, be months and weeks. This is instant. So much so that I'm just in the process this summer, with the help of a really skilled medical student, putting together what I call a savant syndrome registry. And this is because what happened is I knew about a number of savants and had written about them or had them posted on the website. But I would get these reports and I just kept stuffing them into a file, which I called New Savants. And it got thicker and thicker and thicker, and I had many cases in that file, but it was not organized in any way. So this summer we've organized that, and just today and tomorrow we're putting the finishing touches on. We have about 350 such cases now in this registry from all over the world, some congenital, some acquired, some sudden. And were it not for the internet, that never would have occurred. Beyond that, it puts me in touch with researchers around the world who are doing are interested in savant syndrome and doing work, and I can share resources with them and trade resources and trade cases, so to speak. So the internet has just been has provided this gold mine of a resource now on savant syndrome.
Yeah, who could have predicted that? And it sounds like you've really got your hands full for somebody, I guess, who is nominally retired. Do you consider yourself retired or not?
Well, if by retired you mean taking in your old tires and putting on a new set of treads, in that sense, I'm retired and going, hope for many more miles. But
I love that definition. I'm going to steal that, if I may.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that's the kind of how I like to look upon retirement is sort of getting a new set of treads and starting out and maybe in different directions. So the number surprised me. I thought in this file of new savants there might be 80 or 90 cases, but as I said, as we've systematically put those together, and now we can begin to analyze them with respect to how many are autistic, how many not, the sex incidence, what is the most common skill, what are these usually multiple skills or single skills, and all those kinds of things to get a much better profile of savant syndrome than ever has existed before.
Yes, and you found that there are certain commonalities. For example, they all seem to manifest in terms of hypermemory or super memory ability. And then you already mentioned the five areas of art, music, calendar calculating, lightning arithmetic calculating, and mechanical spatial skills. So I'm wondering, given those commonalities, what does that tell us about the brain?
Well, I think what, at least my to my way of looking at this now, both in terms of observing savants as well as doing some imaging and other kinds of studies on them, which are really just now beginning and underway. But from my standpoint, there are two things that are happening in savant syndrome. One is that there is injury to one part of the brain, and another part of the brain rewires itself, recruits unused brain capacity, and actually releases dormant capacity, which is already stored. So there is brain damage, and as a result of that, the body compensates by rewiring, by recruiting dormant capacity and releasing some dormant skills. And it turns out that that this tends to be left hemisphere damage and right brain compensation. Now, granted, right brain, left brain is an oversimplification, and we're not, you know, neatly divided. But the fact is also true that the hemispheres do specialize in certain functions. The left hemisphere, dominant hemisphere, for example, specializes in language and logical, sequential kind of thinking, whereas the right hemisphere is much more instant, much more visual, and happens to have the skills that the savant shows in art, music, lightning calculating, calendar calculating, and mechanical or spatial skills. So the first thing that happens, in my opinion, is that there is damage to largely the left hemisphere with a right brain compensation, and the skills that you see are then right brain skills. Now, at the same time as there is that phenomena going on, there is damage probably from whatever the same source of whatever the first caused the first the damage to the left hemisphere to the higher level of memory. We all have certain types of memory, but one is cognitive or semantic memory, and that is our factual memory. Or as you ask me a question and I search my cortex and out hopefully comes the answer from my memory bank. And that's cognitive or semantic language, and it serves us very well. But we also have what's called procedural or habit memory. And these are things that we incorporate unconsciously. For example, let's say you're learning to ride a bike. When you first try to learn to ride a bike, you're aware of the balance and where the pedals are, and you're going. And then pretty soon, in that "I've got it" moment, you learn how to ride a bike, and that's just unconscious. Or as I drive from here to Chicago, for example, and I'm maybe thinking about my upcoming interview with you today or whatever. But I'm also weaving back and forth in traffic. I'm taking exits sort of unconsciously and without even thinking about it. And sometimes when I get to Chicago, I can't remember whether I went through Racine or not. And that's habit or procedural memory. It's very deep, but very, very narrow. So the second thing that happens in savants is that there is damage to the higher level memory circuits, and they are left then with habit memory, which is exceedingly deep, but very, very narrow. And so when you see a savant, what you see are largely these right brain skills or characteristic skills of the savant coupled with this marvelous memory. However, the memory tends to be very, as I said, very narrow, but very within very narrow limits, but very, very deep. And so I think what it says about the brain, to get back to your question, is that with respect to the rewiring, recruitment, and release phenomena, we have a lot of dormant and unused brain capacity, probably as a backup system or as a backup to, in case there is injury. And the second thing that it says is that we also have several kinds of memory, and that again, as a backup system to the damage to the semantic memory, there's reliance then on the procedural memory. And so when you see a savant, what you typically will see is one of these skills that we mentioned within these five areas, and coupled with this marvelous memory, but it's a memory of a particular type.
Well, that's a really nifty model. I mean, it's kind of easy to wrap your mind around it. I'm just amazed by how our understanding of the brain seems to be progressing by leaps and bounds, and your research is certainly contributing to that. Now, you also note that there's a pronounced 6-to-1 male-female gender difference. So I'm wondering, what additional clues about the brain does that suggest?
Well, what the reason for that 6-to-1 ratio in savants and 4-to-1 male-to-female in autism stems from some work that by Geshwin and Galliberta at Harvard a number of years ago. And what they found was that the brain in all of us, in developing in utero, that the left hemisphere completes its development later than the right hemisphere. This is true through the whole human and animal kingdom. And that means that the left hemisphere is exposed for a longer time than the right hemisphere to anything that might be detrimental. It turns out that circulating testosterone, which in the male fetus reaches levels equivalent to an adult male during the time when the fetus is developing its secondary sexual characteristics, it turns out that testosterone can be harmful to neuronal tissue. So what you have is a longer exposed left hemisphere to circulating testosterone in the male, which can damage the left hemisphere, and that obviously is going to occur much more in males than it will in females. And so you end up with this 4-to-1 ratio, not only in autism, but also in learning disabilities, in hyperactivity in children, in stuttering, and in autism itself. And as I mentioned earlier, there is evidence in autism of left hemisphere dysfunction, leaving aside even the savant syndrome. And that stems from this left hemisphere testosterone damage in the male, and that accounts for why there are this 4-to-1 male female ratio in a number of other conditions, including language disorders, which is not surprising because typically the left hemisphere is the one that is specializing in language.
Now, these things are never as simple as we would like them to be. Are there also genetic factors?
For example, one can raise the question, all right, with the acquired savant and after a head injury, why is it only some people develop savant skills? Why is it not true that everyone who has a left brain injury would show some savant skills? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, it depends on where the injury is. We know, for example, that the left anterior temporal area is much more likely, both in autism and in people with head injuries, to tap some of this dormant potential. But it also depends on what I call the talent pool that's available. And we know, for example, that talent tends to be somewhat genetically determined. Some of us are some families are athletes, and others have none. Some families are musical, and others there is no musical ability. So there are families where math is it comes easy, mm-hmm. and others where it comes hard. I fall in that latter category. I never understood second level algebra, but. And so we have these, not only are there these different types of talent distributed amongst us, but also it's distributed in varying amounts in what I call the usual bell-shaped curve. There are some people who have no athletic ability. There are some of us who have sort of normal or natural, and then there are people at the far end of the extreme of the bell-shaped curve who have extreme, Michael Jordan level abilities. And that's distributed along the bell-shaped curve, just as our height is, for example. Some of us are short, some are tall, and most of us fall in the middle. And that's a genetically determined trait. So both with respect to the autistic savants as well as the acquired savants, it depends on the genetic talent pool that is available will determine to some degree not only the type of skill that the savant shows, but also the degree that it's present. As we look at, it's been interesting to me as we look at savants and their families that many times you'll find a musical savant where there really has not been any particular musicians in the family or people without any exceptional skills. But the more I look at these families and the farther I look at them in terms of extended family, I'm not talking just about mom and dad. I'm talking about an aunt or an uncle or a cousin. It's and many times it may be one or two generations back that there is somebody. For example, I remember a case where this was a mathematical savant, and there didn't seem to be anybody in the family who had any particular skill beyond ordinary. And yet, as we've traced the family back, indeed, there was a professor of mathematics several generations back in that family that somebody just happened to remember. Oh, I remember, grandpa telling me about uncle, so forth and so on. So there is a genetic component, indeed.
Now, you mentioned the 1988 film Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman, on which you were a consultant. How accurate was that story? I gather it was based on a real person who you worked with, Kim Peek. I think you also dedicated your book to him, if I recall correctly.
That's correct. Right.
Yeah. How accurate was that? And tell us about his phenomenal memory and calculating abilities.
Sure. Well, the background to the movie Rain Man is an interesting one. Rain Man was written by Barry Morrow, who lives in California and is still doing screenwriting. Some years back, he had written two made-for-television screenplays called Bill, in which Mickey Rooney played a person who was mentally retarded, and some people still remember that. Depends on how old you are, whether you remember that or not. But and those received Emmys and were excellent made for television movies. Just by chance, one day, in fact, Barry Morrow was coming to talk to the Association for Retarded Citizens to tell them to receive an award from them for the Bill movie, the two movies on Bill 1 and 2. And just by chance, Kim Peek and his father happened to be at that same conference. And the father had to go to the meeting, and so Barry was left with Kim in this room, and sort of a library-like room. And Kim began to go around the room, and Barry would ask him if he had ever heard of this book. And Kim would say, would not only know that he heard about it, but he began to recite from it. That he had memorized this particular book or that particular book. And then they began to look at directions and maps and also Kim had noted that in this association's mailing list, there were a whole series of wrong zip codes. And so Barry was just so impressed by Kim Peek and decided to write, to make a movie about, and at least inspired by Kim Peek. However, and so he went home and he wrote the movie Rain Man. And inspired by Kim Peek, but it is not Kim Peek's story. Actually, the original depiction was to be someone with mental retardation, just as Bill, but a decision was made along the line to depict someone with autism, because autism had never really been portrayed on the screen before. And so the main character in the movie, Raymond Babbitt, was cast as autistic. And
was Kim Peek autistic?
No, Kim Peek is not autistic. He has some autistic traits.
Uh-huh.
But actually, Kim Peek was had some congenital abnormalities, including an absent corpus callosum, which is that's a huge structure in the brain, and
The structure that connects the two halves, the two hemispheres, right?
That's correct, right? And he was born. Kim was born with a encephalocele, or a sort of a hernia of the brain, a small a golf ball sized hernia with part of the brain outside the skull, and then it sort of reduced itself naturally, but it left him, or there was no corpus callosum, and it left him with some other cerebellar and other central nervous system damage. And so he has some autistic traits, some of his hand gestures and rocking and so forth, but he was not autistic. So when Barry made the character Raymond Babbitt, it was inspired by Kim, but it was not Kim's story. And I think people have to understand when they watch the movie that they are really looking at two things. One is that they're looking at autism, rearranging the salt shakers and Judge Wapner at 3 o'clock, underwear at Kmart, and all those kind of things. Those are autistic characteristics but superimposed on that is the savant syndrome, being able to compute square roots, the card counting at the Las Vegas, counting the toothpicks as they fall. So you're really seeing two things, and that's what savant syndrome is. Savant syndrome is not a condition in and of itself. It is superimposed on some other underlying disability, and so the movie, as I said, was inspired by Kim, but it is not Kim Peek's story. In fact, the story, the Rain Man is a composite savant, but all of the things that you see, all of the scenes that I mentioned, and all the other things that he was able to do, including memorize the phone book, eating the cheese curls with a toothpick. Those are all based on real people, as opposed to some screenwriter's fantasy at all. It just happens that they are a composite and put into one individual.
Kim Peek had near perfect memory for something like 12,000 books.
Yeah, and Kim Peek is I call him the Mount Everest of memory. We always use the term one of a kind, or the eighth wonder of the world, or whatever. But I think Kim Peek qualifies as probably the most expansive memory ever, or at least ever reported. He had, starting at a very early age, where he began to memorize the encyclopedias at age 3 or 4 or 5, had the capacity to memorize books. And this
was just by flipping through the pages, right?
Yeah, right. And
not working at it the way that we work to memorize something.
No, and the reason that he could do that was because he would read one eye, one page with one eye, and the other page with the other eye, which is the only person I've ever known to have that skill. Maybe it exists. And so he would, when you see him reading a book, he's flipping the pages, and they immediately go to his hard disk. And I'm talking about specific passages from the book and the page number. I'm talking about being able to bring that up on your Kindle, you know, now.
Right.
He was sort of a living Kindle, if you want to, in the sense that from all of these books and newspapers that he read as well, he had what has to be the world's largest factual database, memory base of anyone within 13 or 14 areas of his interest. If it was not an area of his interest, he simply didn't pay attention to it, including math. He was not a good math person. If you asked him a math question, he would simply sort of say, "That's none of my job description," or you know, something. But even though he was a calendar calculator he memorized within these areas would be, for example, history, a biography, the Bible, geography, and other philosophy. If you asked him, a geographical place, if you asked him where is such and such a place, he would not only tell you that, he would tell you the history of the place and how it got its name and what it used to be called before it was called what it presently is, and would make these massive associations, naming all of the kings of England and going back to earlier times, within these areas, and sort of an encyclopedia kind of thing. And for a long time with Kim, he would recite these facts. For example, if you asked him, you know, what are the six largest cities in Sweden, and then Norway, and then Czechoslovakia, or whatever, he would tell you that. Recalling these facts as if looking it up in an encyclopedia. But in later years, he began to put these facts together in an associative kind of way and became a living Google, so that you could retrieve not only the fact, but he would then make associations to those facts. For example, if you asked him, he also had a startling musical memory, not just factual memory for the names of the pieces, but you could play most any piece that he'd ever heard, and he would identify that piece by name. But he also would tell you who wrote it, when that person was born, when that person died, when the piece was first performed, and what we now know the piece as in more popular music. And it just was this associative thing, which was just getting, unfortunately, Kim died in December of last year, but this associative thing was getting to be much more prominent. And he was, in many ways, ahead of the rest of us in terms of making these associations. Sometimes he would make the association, and it would take us or his dad a while sometimes to figure out what is the association. For example, somebody asked him, "What do you know about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony?" And he says, "Churchill." "Well, Kim, I don't get it. What, you know?" "Well, dot, 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 dum is the Morse code for the letter V."
Oh,
and Churchill always was holding up V for victory, and then he would recite one of Churchill's speeches. So he was, but he would make other associations that were harder to figure out, but eventually one would be able to. For example, somebody asked him, "What do you know about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address?" And he said something like 231 Front Street or something to that effect. "Well, I don't get it." That's where Lincoln stayed in Gettysburg the day before he gave his famous speech. So that was his address in Gettysburg.
It sounds like maybe there was a sense of humor lurking in there.
Yes, there is. And it's interesting that wits and puns are an obscure skill or a poorly reported skill, but in this series of 300 plus savants, there are others where witticisms and puns are the particular capacity. And Kim was showing. And I use that example, or use that as an example of what I have seen as the transition in all the savants, whether it's music or art or memory, is that originally, or first of all, I've always been impressed with their startling recall, whether it's a ability to play a piece back, having heard it one time, or for Alonzo Clemons to look at an animal and to capture that animal exactly as he saw it. But as time goes on, and or Stephen Wiltshire, who can gone by helicopter over a number of cities now for 45 minutes and then spends the next 3 days drawing that building window by window and brick by brick with absolute recall.
Not just a building, but the whole, but all the buildings in the city are,
yes,
a wide swath of them.
Right. In fact, the cover of the book, my book, it's his drawing of London. But so there is that spectacular recall. But then over time, the savant begins to improvise. And so what has been spectacular, for example, with Leslie Lemke that I worked with for years now, his spectacular recall of music, he'll recall it for you. But then he wants to improvise, and he'll play his own improvisations on the theme as if he's bored with just recalling. And then finally, beginning to actually create music and compose. And so in all the savants over time, there is this transition from spectacular recall to improvisation to creation. When I first started this, my tour with savants, I felt that they were not very creative as a group. In fact, I wrote that in my first book, and that's not true. If you wait long enough, you'll see the creativity. So in Kim, this witticism and puns are his improvisation and now his creation, really. He gets bored with just telling you what date you were born, you know, what the day of week when you were born and how old, what day it'll be when you turn 65. And it's interesting, in fact, with Stephen Wiltshire, who does these spectacular drawings of cities, did one some months ago and over New York City. And Stephen said that was his last one, the last one that he was going to do. And we asked him how come, and he said, I'm getting bored by doing them. But and so now he's doing more freestyle, and he's done Sydney, Australia since, so he's still doing it. But he didn't give it up completely. But the puns and witticisms, I think, are evidence of Kim's creativity. There are some, sometimes this the memory that savants have and sometimes the skills turn out to be as much of a force as they are a gift. Alonzo has to sculpt and Leslie has to play. And if they don't, they get agitated or you know, it's something they have to do. So sometimes to the family, it gets to be a, I don't know how many times Mary has heard Tchaikovsky's, you know, first piano concerto from Leslie, with whom he now lives, because he has to play. He has to play a certain number of hours each day. But so there is that that force, and sometimes the memory gets to be a gets in the way a little bit. In fact, with Kim, his father Fran tells of them going to a Shakespeare play recently. And in the middle of, or toward the end of the play, Kim stands up and says, "Stop! Stop the play!" And the actor says, "Sir, I don't. What's the problem?" He said, "You missed a word."
Oh no!
And the actor said, "Sir, first of all, I didn't think anybody would notice, and secondly, I didn't think anybody would care." And Kim said, "Well, Shakespeare would have cared."
Oh.
So and the same thing with concerts that Kim remembers not just the piece in its entirety, but each of the instruments and when the trombone is supposed to come in and so forth and so on. And so sometimes, at least he doesn't at least toward the end there, he didn't interrupt concerts, but he would often be compelled to go up after the concert and talk to the conductor and remind him that in this particular piece, did you realize that, you know, something had happened that wasn't supposed to be there? So it was just a massive memory. But he was such a gentle soul also and a kind soul. And he would get very upset about, in fact, he oftentimes could not watch the news because he would get very upset about unfairness or a tragedy, a tornado. Why does that happen? And so sometimes I think the rest of us, we might say, well, you know, put that in perspective or say, well, those things happen and so forth. But his rigidity in that regard sometimes would be a form of torment for him.
Sounds like there needs to be a new movie, one that hews closer to who he really was, because a fascinating person.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I hope to be able to co-edit a book with his father, because Kim is not just to chronicle his remarkable abilities, but there was a considerable amount of study of him with imaging and with neuropsychological testing and with the corpus callosum abnormality that really needs to be available in the literature to future researchers. And it's sort of scattered now between magazine articles and video clips and so forth, but it really needs to be put into one place. It's like Luria's book, The Mind of a Memnist, which chronicled a person he had worked with, Mr. S, for many years. And it's been a real carefully put together source book for people now looking at memory. And I think the same thing with Kim. And I guess also with respect to the movie Rain Man, there are many people who sort of objected to the way the movie ended, where Raymond went back to the institution. They wanted him to be out of the institution and go to the Dodgers game with his brother, you know, a 6-day cure of autism. That's just not realistic. But if you had a sequel to Rain Man now, what you would see is that the progress that Raymond Babbitt would make and eventually go into a community facility and become more self-supporting. And so the chapters of what happens, the savant skills are not just frivolous, gee whiz, look at that, isn't that interesting skills. They are the language that these people are using, and it's their way of communicating to us. And if you train the talent, as I call it, they develop even better language and more daily living skills and more independence. And I've got example after example of that. And so I think in that sense, a follow-up to Rain Man would be useful to see what, you know, that Raymond didn't spend the rest of his life in the institution by any means, but became part of us and in the community. And that's what's happening more and more now with not just with savants, but with autism in general. And in that sense, I think it's a very positive. In fact, my whole experience with this has been one of great optimism, not just for savants, but for brain research in general. When we consider, I think, you know, that the brain is such a marvelous, I mean, we take it for granted, like we take a lot of things for granted. But when you really think about that 3 pounds of jello-like substance and what it can do, you know, we marvel. I keep marveling at how smaller and smaller the flash drives are getting and how much you can put on the flash drives. But that is nothing compared to what is stored in our own head over a whole lifetime. So it's made me much more in awe of not just of what the savant can do, but of that marvelous brain that we have and how we can use it better and more. Not only for people who have brain damage and stroke, post-stroke, to help them heal better, but within ourselves to expand our own capabilities and without waiting until we have a stroke or something that puts us in touch with that part of ourselves, which is already there.
Well, that thought is probably a good place for us to wrap up the interview, although it would be so easy to go on and to have you tell us. Your book is just full of fascinating information and case histories, but I think we do need to draw to a close.
Sure, indeed.
So, Dr. Daryl Trefford, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I consider it a privilege, and I'm delighted to have been invited.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Daryl Trefford as much as I did. I strongly recommend his very readable book, Islands of Genius, which, in addition to lots of science about savant syndrome, has chapters detailing the lives and abilities not only of Kim Peek, who you heard us discuss, but 13 other savants as well. He's also got two great websites that are chock full of great information about savant syndrome. The first is www.daroldtreffert.com, and that's spelled DaroldTreffert.com. And the other is www.savantsyndrome.com. These are definitely worth spending some time on. In fact, savantsyndrome.com has a large number of video clips of savants in action. Also, there is a 3-hour German film that Dr. Trefford says is quite definitive. The title of the film is Beautiful Minds, A Voyage into the Brain. I wasn't able to find this film on Netflix, but I did see that it's downloadable as a BitTorrent if you're into that. Aside from their intrinsic interest as a curiosity, Dr. Trefford rightly suggests that these savants give us a window on the inner workings of the brain and perhaps our own unrealized potential.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everybody. I hope I can articulate clearly today. I had a rather difficult time in the dentist chair a few days ago, and have been feeling very beat up, and am still in some pain, which I've been controlling with Motrin and Vicodin. It does feel like it's slowly getting better. I'm hoping I don't need a root canal, and so I'm trying to tough it out to see if the tooth settles down. So between the residual drugs and pain, I may be a bit mumble-mouthed here. I hope not. By the time you hear this, there should be a new interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com, and it will be with Daniel R. Strunk, Ph.D., who's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at The Ohio State University, and who's published research on the effectiveness of cognitive therapy in treating depression. If by any chance you're listening to this podcast and you're not subscribed, just do it. It costs nothing. And it does help me to track how many listeners I have. And you can do it through the link on our site, which will help you to there's the mumble mouth. There is a link on our site which will help you to subscribe in iTunes. Let me remind you that you can find links to our Twitter, Shrink Wrap Radio, Facebook fan page, and Yahoo discussion group in the right-hand sidebar on our site. The discussion group seems to have just heated up just recently. I've also added several affiliate links in that same area on our website that can both save you money and help to support the show. In addition to 10% off on inkjet cartridges at 4inkjets.com and 25% off a year's membership at Angie's List. There is a new 10% off coupon code for ShoeBuy.com, where you can save money not only on shoes, but also luggage, apparel, and a variety of accessories. So please visit the site for these money-saving opportunities. If you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. It's one of the things that keeps us on the front page of their higher education shows. I'm happy to report that we have a new transcript on the site. It's number 243, Exploring Behavioral Economics with Dan Ariely. This important interview was transcribed by Billy Braddock, who's also offered to do another one. Thanks, Billy. In fact, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. Thanks to all the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, and I'm always looking for new transcribers to help us keep up. And some of you committed to transcribing, but I haven't received those transcripts, so please finish them up. And please contact me if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. Thanks to all of you who have made financial donations, and I especially appreciate several people who have just renewed their year-long pledges. That provides an important, predictable base, which is greatly appreciated. If you haven't done so yet, please go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on that big green donate button.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kira, who has made me the proud grandfather of three. Instead of reading listener emails as I usually do, I'd like to play a voicemail left by listener Brandon in Christchurch, New Zealand, recounting the harrowing experience of the earthquake there and the tremors that were going on at the time of this recording. Here's Brandon.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Brandon calling from Christchurch, New Zealand. On Saturday, the 4th of September, we had a 7.1 Richter scale earthquake here at like 4:30 in the morning, and we're woken up. It's now Friday the 10th, and we're still having a lot of aftershocks, which are really scary. But I woke up at 4:30, jumped out of bed. The whole house was absolutely shaking, and I thought it was going to collapse on us. I jumped up and got my daughter out of bed, got the rest of the kids, there's four kids that we needed to get up and sort it out, and we got them in the hallway and under the doorways. But I actually since then have found out that you shouldn't be, and at a big earthquake, you shouldn't be hanging around the doorways, because the house can still collapse and the roof can fall on you. So the best thing to do is get buy furniture. And if the roof collapses, it can cause a little triangle of life, I think they call it, a little space there. Whereas, you know, here, even in New Zealand, we're still being told to get underneath tables or furniture or under the doorways. But in fact, they, of course, can collapse and crush you. But it was dark when it happened, and I could hardly hold on. My wife, she got up with our baby, a 15-month-old baby, and she's got a black eye and bruised foot where she was violently thrown around the bedroom trying to get to the doorways. I've got a 4-year-old daughter. She's still traumatized from the event, but at the time she was absolutely terrified, shaking, vomiting. It was the most scariest thing. I don't know how long the quake lasted for. It felt like 10 minutes, but I'm sure it was probably only a couple of minutes. It's really scary. It's to fear for your life. I've never experienced anything like this in my life, and the fear still continues. A lot of people in Christchurch here just want to move out of their homes and move away. That's the people that where there are homes that are not destroyed. Mine was okay. I've got an old wooden house, and there was just a lot of cracking. The foundations are cracked. The house has moved a bit on the foundation, but we're pretty lucky here because the house is built on top of a I think there's sand under the ground, whereas there's places just outside of Christchurch called Kaiapoi where they had a lot of mud underneath the ground, and of course liquefaction occurs, which makes the whole ground tremble and brings all the fluid to the top of the surface. I'm still shaking now as I talk. We've just had a tremor, and I think it was a 5.4 on the Richter scale, whereas the one we had at the night on the Saturday morning was a 7.1. It was about 33 k's under the ground and about 30-odd k's, kilometres away from the centre of Christchurch where we are. But I tell you what, it was massive. It was, not good. So I just thought I'd share that because there's people don't realise just the psychological aspect of what's left over is the fact that you've got so many tremors, after tremors that continue. Like I think I've seen earthquakes on TV before in different countries and thought, well, okay, there's probably the post-traumatic stress and the psychological stress of what occurred typically, but it's never occurred to me that the tremors continue and just the wearing down, the effects that occur over a long period, like the aftershocks can continue for several weeks. It's nearly been a week now, and every time one happens, I'm just about jumping out of my skin. People aren't sleeping at night, particularly as it occurred at night time. I notice I get more fearful at night. I jump at noises. Anytime a car comes past our house, it's has a very low rumble, like the earthquake or the aftershocks. Often when they come, you can hear them before they hit. Although we might be getting some like 5.4 aftershocks, the depth of them in the ground can change how violent they are. I noticed the shallow ones at about 5 kilometres depth are very similar to the 7.1 at 33 kilometres of depth. So it makes a huge difference. I'm just lucky that we're lucky no one was killed here in Christchurch. But there's a lot of clean-up to be done. I'm not working at the moment because my building, the building I work in, has been damaged. So luckily I'm still being paid by my employer. But some employers aren't paying their staff. We're still in a state of emergency a week later. Keep up the good work, Dr. Dave, and wish you all the best, and I hope I'm still safe. Thanks.
My goodness. Well, Brandon, I do hope that you and your family are still safe. I saw an article in today's paper saying that there have been over 300 post-quake tremors and that the damage has run over $2 billion. That's $2 billion. Our hearts go out to all those in Christchurch whose lives have been impacted by this tragic event. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, or as Brandon did, you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Daryl Treffert, both for his groundbreaking work and for sharing it with us. My next show will be with Barry Spector, who has just written a very provocative book titled Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. I hope you'll join me then. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.